Part 5. Mirror Flowers. A man who carries a cat by the tail learns something he can learn in no other way. Mark Twain. 17. Cliff and his party followed Quirt at an easy, loping pace. The lower gravity made long strides easy, but the humans could not match the ease of the Sill's fluid grace. There was no ground transport except the Sill City subway, but that had been damaged too. Quirt said it was intermittent and unreliable.
"Smoke go in there, and some say be worse things."
They made their way beyond the ruined Sill City and broke into open woodlands. It was a relief to suck in soft, moist air and just move, escape. No one looked back. They paused on a short hill, and Cliff could not resist a last perspective on the blasted landscape. Its once proud ramparts and arches, its residential precincts, its lofty spires of what might have been elegant churches, all burned or hammered down to rubble. The folk had no mercy. Yet he could see rising from rubble the tan buildings they had watched self-forming with a quiet, eternal energy. Seen at a distance, the fresh shoots of new life moved like stop-motion videos, eager plants rising to begin anew a city that surely, in the immense history of the bowl, had been rebuilt myriad times. Cliff sighed and clasped Irma to his side. "It's coming back. Slow but steady."
"This place was made to replace itself, a technology that counts on having to regenerate. I wonder what it runs on."
"Solar energy, reprocessed waste. Did you see that molecular printer Quirt used to make us your new carry pack?" She nodded and shrugged the new pack, easing the straps.
"Great, some kind of light composite stuff. Made a molecule at a time," Quirt said. "It's built exactly like the old busted one, minus the broken frame from when I fell down."
Cliff shrugged. "If you hadn't been down, that flame beam would have burned you."
"Yeah, lucky break."
She puffed her overhanging hair back from her eyes, a classic gesture of bemused frustration.
"Dumb luck. Poor old Howard ran out of luck."
"Damn shame. He was always getting hurt, breaking something, even getting lost to go pee."
"Some people are like that. Crew selection was by fleet merits, you know, not backpack experience. Resumes don't account for plain old bad luck that keeps coming back."
"Sure enough, big mistake. Next starship I'm on, I'll remember that." She laughed and punched him in the arm, which drew sidelong glances from Terry and Abby. Even Quirt noticed. "Well, let him," Cliff thought. "Not like it's been a lot of fun lately." Then they pressed on, turning their backs on the burgeoning city that would live again. Quirt led the way, with other Sill flanking them. They all carried weapons, long, slim tube launchers. Their faces were grim, focused, and they did not seem to tire. Relentless sunlight streamed down through the symphonic play of ivory clouds. Tall and cottony, they were so vast that parts of them were laced through with blue tinges of moist anvils. Clouds as anthologies. The anvils hanging in the soft mist of larger puffballs, lightning sheeting across denser purple knots, all of it like separate cities of the sky, tapering away into the far heights. Here and there, clots condensed out, their understories fading into rainfalls, sheets of pale blue falling great distances, then absorbed back into the air before ever striking the bowl. Cliff said to Irma and Abby, "Relax into tourist mode." And they all chuckled, not because it was funny, but because everyone needed an excuse to smile. They came into a flash of green, almost pornographically abundant in the smoky, almost rotting aroma of turned black earth, rain sweating down from passing squalls, air thickened with rich purpose. A vehicle purred past, and from its big tailpipe, a lush pale blue cloud gushed. Irma drew in a breath of it and said,
"You can almost smell dinosaurs in that. It smells like a fossil fuel."
Abby sniffed. "Probably ethanol, but it sure smells rich." None of them had actually ever smelled the exhaust of a true oil burner on an Earthside that was scrupulous about emissions. Only jet airplanes using turbines rated fossil fuel use back when Sunseeker left the solar system.
Cliff wondered if by now Earthside Biotech had engineered anything like the skyfish here, living beasts that could float and fight. He doubted it. What biological substrate could they start with to develop such bizarre forms? That made him consider how the folk had ever engineered their skyfish. From some airborne floaters found on some planet where thick air and light gravity made that an optimal path? Big, slow, made invulnerable by its size, like elephants or whales or a brontosaurus? This place is like a museum of other life forms, he thought, but one that keeps evolving. Maybe that was part of the point of building the bowl itself? An ongoing moving experiment with more room than a million planets? They entered a broad plain of short grass, and there was a trampled, much-traveled track stretching into the hazy distance. Straight up in the air, though, momentary openings between the towering clouds gave a dim vision of the bowl hanging in a pale eggshell blue sky. Cliff watched the watery vision of huge lands shimmer, a vision from all the way across this solar system. Only it's not any solar system we ever envisioned, he thought. More like a huge contraption made of a system's parts. Back on Sunseeker before they came down, Fred the engineer type had estimated the bowl's mass and got more than Jupiter, more probably than there was in the Kuiper Belt or the Oort Cloud. Somebody had scavenged an entire expanse of space, maybe all the worlds that circled Wickram Singh's star, to make this thing. Along the trampled path, occasional sill held out strings of fish, stringy root-like vegetables, a gauzy plant like a haze of wire. He realized these were for sale, but of course the humans had nothing like sill cash. Passing these hawkers, making poor imitations of the sill no-no-no eye gestures, they went by. Here and there a sill stepped forward, lowered its head, and held goods up, waving them toward the humans. An offering. This struck Irma as an eye-widening surprise. Cliff knew enough to take some food, with eye moves of thanks, and then wondered how to cook the food that began accumulating. All this occurred silently, for the sill seemed to relish a gentle, still presence. It was usually hard to get them to talk at all, and when they did, they were terse. Across the plain came small, darting vehicles sheathed in shiny silver metal. Some moved toward the humans, though most went their own way. A knot of about a dozen sill cars eased up in the purring machines and shut them down. With proper greetings, they got out to address court. They had a conversation taking at least 20 minutes. That was long enough for the humans to sit near the cars and find out which of the gift foods they could eat raw. Hand meal, the sill called this. Sill talked while they ate. When Irma asked about that, Court had consulted an electronic aid he sometimes used to translate and said, "Sportiverse." This apparently meant creating poetry, a ritual perhaps parallel to humans drinking alcohol and singing together. They were hungry. There was a pleasant, nutty spiral fruit that left a peppery taste. They ate it all and had moved on to a nearly rhomboid-shaped bittersweet fruit. Court and three other sill came over to the humans, doing the head moves and eye signals that always came before an important discussion. Cliff reflected on how much they had learned about sill culture by simply watching their social cadences. Humans talked all the time, Court had noted with genuine wonder, as though that were uncommon on the bowl. Court said,
"They gift movers to us."
"We are gift happy," Irma said, smiling and nodding. She was better at ferreting out the meanings of the clipped sill sentences and echoing their manner. She kept track of the myriad eye and head gestures and tried to imitate them, though not always with much success. There had been some amusing errors, such as when she had inadvertently asked Court if sex was part of their diet, or where the beds were to be, and then walked into the rather primitive male toilets. She could not then tell male from female sill and had to be told with furious elbow signals. The small, squat vehicles were actually simple to drive. They used hands and feet, just as Earthside cars did, and ran on an auto-gear system with adjustable constraints, mostly, apparently, magnetic. Indeed, its propulsion seemed magnetic, but it never rose more than a meter above the broad plain. Everything here, even the homes, seemed powered by electromagnetic induction through the bowl's substructure. There were solar collectors everywhere, befitting a land where the sun always shone, and the self-shaping buildings were driven that way, too. Cliff could tell by the occasional tinkling of electrical discharge that ran over his skin when he stood near the walls, as they surged up and formed elegant cusps and arches. Court showed Cliff how to drive the mag car, seeming to insist it was a guest's privilege. That let him take the little thing out onto the broad plain, Court in the co-pilot seat, and Irma and A.B. in the rather cramped rear seats. Their backpacks and gear went in racks on the roof, secured by a curious self-wrapping lattice that figured out its own way to secure the arrangement, tripped by a tiny tapping from Court. They headed on toward distant mountains, cloud-shrouded and mysterious. Court then went into comm mode, using the inbuilt dash system to get in touch with the other Syl, using a system Court said the folk could not intercept. Court apparently had embedded acoustic receivers, for it peered ahead intently and sub-vocalized, face giving nothing away. Irma sat in the back, and the others were in another car, following close on the right side. Cliff took the odd mag car up to its highest speed as other car traffic thinned out. They were moving away from the Syl concentrations, but Cliff had no idea of their destination. He did not notice nearby cars or anyone following until abruptly one drew up alongside them. It deftly came in and blocked them from the other human car. The two Syl inside did not look at him, but they matched exactly his velocity. Then the mag car started coming in closer. He thought nothing of it until they were only a car length away. He slowed. They slowed. He sped up. So did they. Another mag car came in from his left, moving fast. Its driver also didn't even seem to notice the three cars moving now together. They all peered straight ahead. Maybe they're a guard party? He wondered. Closer. Closer. Cliff had time to say, "Quirt? Quirt?" interrupting the alien's concentration, its eyes slowly coming fully open, as if it had been in a trance. "I think something's..." A third car came over fast from the left, slightly ahead. It slewed hard and set itself up exactly in front of their car. Irma said, "Are these..." The lead car slowed, its big tail signal sliding in ruby-red pulses across the back. Cliff had to step on the mag brakes, and the car hummed loudly. He tried to maneuver to the left, then right, but there was no room now, and then the car ahead braked harder. Cliff slammed on the brakes. The three that had boxed him in hit theirs a few seconds later. The brake howl was a high scree, all of them losing speed as fast as they could. The cars were identical, so they hardly separated at all as the howling deceleration threw Cliff forward. They all wore odd net belts that stopped Cliff from being heaved onto the windshield. His few seconds' lead in decelerating meant he was now about 10 meters behind them all as they slid to a stop, throwing gray dust and the humming loud and shrill. Irma was saying something, and Quirt too, but Cliff focused on the six Syl who jumped out of the mag cars. They called short, crisp orders to each other and reached into their work belts. Going for weapons, Cliff thought, not guards. The Syl ran around their cars and formed an orderly bunch, intent on Cliff's car, shouting now. Quirt gave its gravel growl and took off its web belt. Irma gave an alarmed cry. "The only weapon we have, we're inside." Cliff saw what he must do. He slammed on the acceleration and shot forward. The car shook as he hit the Syl. Impact scattered them across the blunt, shiny hood. Bodies struck their windshield and rolled up it, tumbling over the roof, dull thumps, and Cliff kept his foot on the accelerator until just before they hit the forward car. They slammed in hard, and the magnetic bumper pushed them back, lessening the impact. Their mag car's hood crumpled. Alarms blared an odd hooting call in Cliff's ears. Court cried out in surprise, and Irma went silent. "Okay," Cliff said, surprised at how mildly he said it. "Irma? Court?"
"Oh, okay," Irma said.
Coughed, gasped. Abby said, "What the—" Court caught Cliff's eye and gave the assent signal. Its mouth sagged open. He had scooped up all the Syl. Some had rolled off to the side and others over the cabin. They had all absorbed the full hard impact of the car, giving off sharp, surprised cries. He watched where they had hit the plane.
None bounced back up. They wanted to grab us, maybe kill us. No negotiation. Went for their weapons. Some of them had gotten their odd little guns free and lay stretched out, guns in hand but arms not moving. Cliff backed out, turning to his left so the car glided over the bodies on that side. They crunched beneath the mag car. He got 10 meters behind the bodies and shifted. He moved forward very deliberately and ran over the ones sprawled on the right. Moving fast, he slewed to ride over the two in front. Each body nudged the car up, no more, but that brought the full pressure of the mag car down on them. He knew the bumps meant smashed bones, organs, spurting gouts of fluids lost into the soil. Agony, screams, the light fading behind terrified eyes. None of them moved as Cliff then backed all the way out and drove around the whole mess. No point in checking to see if anyone survived. Irma said,
"The other car's gotten free, too. Looks like they have a sill driving."
"My mate," Quirt said quietly. "She fine. Drive hard."
Cliff glanced at the alien, who seemed as quiet and calm as ever. Terry was in the other car and waved at them, holding thumbs up.
"They must have done something similar," Abe said quietly. "Wasn't watching."
Cliff amped the acceleration and had them up to max speed by the time the cars and bodies were just a dot in his side rearview screen. He was surprised that he did not need to think much at all about what had happened. The three-car team had tried to grab those he cared about and were willing to use force to do it. That meant they had crossed a line. Cliff had spent endless days stacking and processing bodies, and now knew he was not the same man. He had done what he had to do, and had not taken any time to think it through. Before he came down to the bowl, he had been another sort of man entirely. This place had taught him a lot, and most of it he could not say, but perhaps comprehended it better that way. It was in his nervous system now. Experience digested and made part of himself. Maybe that was what Quirt had. Indeed, maybe the Sill had it without having to learn. In the silence of the mag car, he felt himself relax. The mountains ahead loomed large now beneath their mantle of anvil clouds, bellies ripe with purple richness, ready to rain as they climbed the slopes. Already he looked forward to that. He would get out of the car and let the falling big drops hammer him with their wealth and feel each moment for what it was, for the joy of it entire.
"Those wanted capture," Quirt said.
"I figured that," Irma said. "Killing us is easier."
"Our chances would not be good in their tender care," Cliff said.
"Give us to the folk. Show loyalty."
Quirt made a head shrug. "So, you killed them?" Irma said.
Cliff nodded. "Probably so."
Irma let that ride and then said,
"They would have gotten in their cars and come after us."
Cliff thought that was obvious and kept his attention on their rear views and the mountains ahead. No visible pursuit. He reminded himself that attack could easily come from above. A skyfish could be hovering a kilometer up, and he glanced out the window, not obvious until it was too late.
"Worrying isn't thinking," he thought,
using a saying he had honed in the long, unending days of pursuit when they were first on the run across the bowl. Perpetual alert could degenerate into a floating anxiety that robbed the mind of concentration, sent it skittering into pointless knots. Not returning to the same damn subject was a learned skill, he saw.
"Where do we go now?" he said directly to Quirt.
"Into cold,"